The United Lodge of Theosophists is an association of students. More importantly, it is an association of individuals who are independently devoted to the cause of theosophy. And that cause of theosophy is a truer conscious realization of the self and a profounder conviction and practical realization of universal brotherhood as a fact in life and in our everyday lives. So this is the similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching that binds us. There is no need for external means by constitution, bylaws, or officers. Everything operates on the basis of voluntary contribution. And all contributions, whether they be in time, service, money, are greatly appreciated and needed. So in keeping with these general ideas, which are more completely expressed in the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists, in Philadelphia, we have three weekly Zoom meetings. This one on Sunday morning is in the format of a lecture, a panel, or forum talk, and is conducted in a more formal manner and usually presents a theme idea for the entire month and then each subsequent week of the month looking at it from a different perspective. And we'll get into this morning's theme and talk in a few moments. On next Sunday, continuing with the idea of cycles and cyclic law, we will have a forum presentation, which will include the topic, the universal symbolism of Christmas. On Wednesday evenings, we have a study class in the Ocean of Theosophy, written by William Q. Judge. We are in the chapters now dealing with the human constitution, taking up presently the astral body. And the subject for this coming Wednesday's class is the astral senses and powers. On Friday evening, we have an informal gathering in a round table discussion format. And presently, we are using... the book, Living the Life, a collection of articles by B.P. Wadia. And this coming Friday, we are taking up his article entitled Theosophical Reformation. So moving then to our subject matter for this month, and particularly this morning, the general theme for the month is cycles and cyclic law. And last week we looked at the harmony and rhythm of nature, the general operation of cycles in nature around us. This morning we're looking at more specifically the cyclic return of experiences and impressions. So obviously this is going to be a very practical application of the knowledge of cycles in our everyday lives, either as individuals or as groups of individuals. We are getting some background noise, so we request that you mute your microphone. So let's start in a most general way with the basic understanding of the theosophical teaching on cycles. Once again, to recapitulate and re-impress our understanding of this central teaching of theosophy. So we are familiar with cycles as repeating periods of time of varying duration. So we have cycles of seconds, of minutes, of days, of months, of years, of decades, of centuries, and so on. But these cycles, and even if we're speaking of seasonal cycles, are primarily understood as recurrences of time events, occurrence of events in a particular time duration. The point that theosophy adds to this is that these cycles have a direct effect and are directly related to human life and human evolution. So in the life of an individual, in the history of nations, races, and civilizations, there are repetitions of events after certain periods of time according to this natural law of periodicity. So there's an interesting quote by HPB to keep in mind. Nature's workshop is one vast clockwork guided by immutable laws. So from this, we should gain the perspective that one cannot force the cycles nor prevent the cycles from returning, as they are intimately related to reincarnation and karmic law. However, one who understands the operation of cycles, cyclic law, and how the cycles recur and their characteristic can work with these cycles to produce wonderful results. And we'll just remind ourselves of one very practical example, which we all know, and that is of in Egypt with the Nile, which periodically floods its banks, and without knowledge of that flooding and knowing how to channel that overflow of water to fertilize the crops and the soil, the Egyptian civilization could never have risen to the height it did. In the same way, there is a rising tide in our physical, mental, moral, psychic, spiritual nature, and if we recognize those tides, we can similarly nourish our physical, psychic, mental, spiritual nature and accomplish wonderful things that we might not otherwise have been able to do. So we cannot prevent the cycles, but we can work well within them. And this first presentation is going to do with just recognizing these cycles and how they affect us. And the second panelist will go more into what can we do with this practically. So we're going to start with a very large cycle. And in ancient times, it was taught throughout the world as it was called, we might call it the Great Year. And it was a period of 21,000 years, which you know corresponds pretty closely to the great sidereal year of 25,000 years, which is the time it takes for the equinoctial points to go through sequentially the various constellations of the zodiac. And so this 21,000 year cycle was divided into two halves. The first 10,500 years culminating finally in a minor cataclysm, and the last 10,500 years culminated in a terrible geological convulsion. And what's interesting is that during these 21,000 years, the polar and equatorial climates gradually exchange places, and the vast polar ice fields slowly become more and more tropical. And with this change of climate, there is necessarily a change in cataclysms and occurrence of cataclysms and earthquakes. And so this phenomena we see of global warming and associated climate change is partially human made, but it's also part of a natural process that has been going on. And the last major cataclysm resulting in geological convulsions and distribution of nations occurred about 10,000 years ago. So we are coming to that rise in the next cycle, 10,000 years, 10,500 years, where there will be more and more changes and minor cataclysms. So that's an interesting recurrence of experience that has been witnessed by humanity again and again. And then there was the coinciding of three great cycles that affect racial development of humanity that occurred at the very end of the 19th century. Now, the first was the coming to the end of the first 5,000 years of the Kali Yuga. And the Kali Yuga is a name for a dark age, very similar to the Iron Age of the Greeks, that is said to last 432,000 years. But even within this large cycle, there are smaller cycles. And the first 5,000 years of this larger Kali Yuga cycle or Iron Age marks a very important point. And what we see is not just a rapid moving age where cause follows effect, effect follows cause much more quickly, and there is a lot of development of materialism to a much greater degree. We also see at this end of this 5,000 year marked by an age of transition where everything in human affairs, even the environment and the geology of the earth, goes through convulsion and change. So it's not just a physical thing, but it affects the development of civilizations as well. Also at the end of the 19th century, we had another cycle coming to close, another historical cycle called the Messianic Cycle of 2,185 years. And in each of these cycles, the equinoxes are processing through one of the constellations of the zodiac. So in the year 2410 BC, it moved through Ram. And then 233 BC, it moved through Pisces. And then towards the end of the very end of the 19th century, it moved into, quote, the age or the period of Aquarius. And the symbolism of that is that in this age, in addition to it being a rapid moving age, an age of transition, there is a rise, there's a great change in the psychic idiosyncrasies of humanity. And HB says the psychologists will have a lot of work to do, because we also, with this rise, we see a lot of preponderance of psychic development and interest, but also disturbance in the psychic or psychological nature of humanity. And then we had also the last 25 years of every century seeing a rising tide of spirituality. And what do we mean by that? How do we recognize that in a culture? Because we did go through such an age in the last 25 years of the 20th century. So in this last 25 years, that rise in spirituality, HPB explains, we see a rising aspiration in human nature to seek for the unknown on the physical, mental, and spiritual planes, an increasing desire to penetrate below the surface of things, a thirst for knowledge which is normally hidden. And this exploration goes on in a not just a physical way, but also a mental and spiritual one. So this rising tide of the metaphysical element of human nature at the last 25 years of every century is accompanied by a natural aspiration towards the mystical, and also a gradual and also, but an increased desire to understand the working of things, the heart of things. And there can be, just as there can be great technological advances and also great spiritual and psychic ones as well. So another important cycle that brings a return of experience and impressions and sensations is that individuals and nations reincarnate together regularly in recurring periods of approximately 1500 years, which gives us a great historical cycle that relates to the progress of civilization. So the souls that make up these ancient civilizations periodically reincarnate together and bring back with them, in essence, their experience, their character, born of impressions, born of that experience, born of that sensation, and they bring back their knowledge and its character. And so we see in modern civilizations echoes of that similar character, experience and knowledge, but perhaps raised to a higher degree or a different expression than it was 1500 years ago. But even without that 1500 year cycle, we know from our study of history of civilizations that all nations and races and civilizations have a periodic rise when it seems as though their intellectual, their spiritual and moral nature is on the upswing. And then we see a periodic decline before another reassertion of humanity to raise itself again. And they're not like abrupt cycles beginning and ending, and they can sort of interblend. And so in one part of the world, we see a rise of civilization at the same time. In another part of the world, we see a gradual decline in that. So that's the operation of cycles in our general experience. But when we come to the individual cycles of return, of sensation, of impression and experience, these are also interwoven with karma and reincarnation. There is not a single impression we have. There is not a single sensation of any kind that we have that will not return. These are self-established cycles of thought and deed. So we've talked already about naturally occurring cycles that we can't force or we can't prevent. But there are a number of cycles, particularly the individual cycles of impression and experience and sensation, that we do influence by the way we think and feel. And the return of that impression, its quality, its strength, is duration, depends and is in accordance with the strength of that first impression. So the first impression, once established, whether through the senses or through a thought, will come back again. And how it recurs, how it comes back again, is very much interpreted and affected by that sensation or impression. And these cycles, the return, they are the result of causes we've set up in this life or before in a previous life or lives. And it's very interesting. We talked about the importance of making good first impressions. Why is that? Because a first impression, strong or weak, will recur again and again. And it's interesting that we meet somebody and they, five of us could meet the same person, have the same experience, and yet the impression, favorable or unfavorable, that person makes on us, even though we all have the same sensory experience, the impression and the way we interpret it will vary with the knowledge, intelligence, perception of the individual. But first impressions, whatever they are very important, because whatever that impression is, it's going to come again and again. And even if we get to know that person better and we see that the first impression we have may not be the complete one, that old and first impression is going to keep coming back and back to modify, to affect, to cloud over. So we may meet somebody that we originally didn't like, but as we got to know them, we liked them better. That doesn't prevent that old impression of doubt, mistrust, and so forth, periodically coming back. And so obviously these returns of impression and sensation are very important to us. And so we'll now turn over our talk to the next panelist, who will go more into how we can use these returns of experience, sensation, impression to our practical use.
Well, we must consider ourselves the human sponge, because we have filled our life with impressions. From the very moment where we enter this world, we are slapped on the bottom and we let out a cry and we start functioning on this plane. But impressions, we know that many have problems in life because of incidents that happened in childhood, that there is not a ready recollection of what happened, but they've been impressed upon us so that we have difficulty making friends, or difficulty in being alone, or a myriad of problems that arises from the impressions that we had at a very early age. Did we hear our parents talking or arguing, or dissensions or unhappiness? All these things have left an impression upon us. So that the impressions that we have are really interpreted by us. The impression, whether it's good, whether it's bad, whether it's indifferent, whether it's enjoyable, it's all a matter of our interpretation. And what is the foundation of that interpretation? How we see ourselves. What are we? You know, are we a poor, miserable sinner? Are we these bodies? Oftentimes, many of us find ourselves with the blues, or being depressed, or not able to rise above some feeling that has us sort of crippled. Well, we are told that not only with this kind of impression, we should always try to create the impressions that we want to return. So that's finding joy, that's finding happiness in the little things of life. That's trying to help someone else, you know, forgetting about your troubles and focusing on the troubles of another. You know, the big impressions, like the sun, the moon, the constellations, they all have an effect upon us. But the little impressions of life have a greater impression on us. We live in a world where we are inundated with impressions. So we have since the earliest of age. And what we have been trying to do is develop discrimination. What is true? What is not true? What is someone else's idea, not my idea? We go through life being bombarded with all these ideas about who and what we are, what is important for us to do. As a theosophist, we are asked to look within. Thou art Buddha. So what does this mean? It means that we have a clear vision if we wish to use it. the clouds or the veil that lies between us and spirit is one that we have created through our likes and dislikes, our wants and our desires. The only way we can overcome this physical life is if we become the masters of our own destiny. And it's done in the simplest of ways, of becoming the master of your own desires, of your own feelings. Because these impressions bombard us. And they stir within us latent feelings of being inadequate, unfulfilled, doubt. And these are the first indicators that we're being manipulated. There is no need to doubt. We know who and what we are. So life is unfolding before us. We're just interpreting it from the impressions that we have of ourselves and the world around us. How do we interpret life? Are you the body? Are you these circumstances? What are we? What is it that we need to do to, you know, help forge that energy enough so that we can rise above these qualities and not be led by them? We need to become the leader. You know, the idea of cycles and the fact is we are creating these impressions now. How do we see life? What kind of attitude do we have? Do we feel bored? Do we feel not inspired? What? We need to find enthusiasm. Enthusiasm with the life that we have, but more with the enthusiasm of the life that we can create. We have the ability to create new impressions and better impressions by the attitude which we have, by the thoughts that we put forward. If we don't look for the results of our actions, if we do what needs to be done, if we are self-centered and working for the good of all, these seem like very simple ideas, but how do we create a new world from this old world? It's by changing our thoughts. Changing our thoughts, that's it. So that, as the Gita says, you know, we are compelled to act. So act as best seemeth unto thee. And the only way we can do that is with spiritual knowledge of how we are that divine spark. We are that star that has descended on this earth, and all those influences of all the universe is within us. All the truth is within us. We just have to make ourselves the vessel so that truth can come forth. Well, we don't know if this brought up any questions or any comments, but you know, cycles are everywhere, day and night, morning and evening, sleeping and waking. You know, the whole day is a cycle. And each day, the morning brings an impression, the evening brings an impression. When the sun is high in the sky, it brings an impression. And how we interpret those impressions determines how we conduct our day. Well, we'll open up the rest of our meeting to comments or questions. Yeah, I think the point that was brought up earlier is how these great cycles do have a way of manifesting, and there are disturbances at the beginning and at the end of these great cycles. So I think the question of climate change and the inevitability of what these teachings tell us is that we're at the confluence of great change. So is there a way that we should be conducting ourselves in this time of great change?
We have a further comment which may help us answer that question. We've called this the return of experience. But what is experience? Is it the same for everybody? Why is it different for everybody? Why is it some people never learn from their experiences or repeat the same experiences over and over again? See, complete sufferings over and over again, can't seem to grow from it or prevent it.
Yes.
In popular culture, on the internet right now, is a very common phrase that's circulating, that we're all in one and the same storm, but each of us is in a different boat. Some in yachts, some in canoes, some in motorboats, and some are drowning. And in that colloquial popular statement is a representation of individual karma, free will and choice, and how the conditions that each of us experience personally in our most immediate spheres of influence are self-created and are returning effects, if you will. So while the cosmic, the greater storm may be going on, the collective may be going on, the conditions through which we have available right now are based on previous efforts of dealing with the conditions. And so what we can do is ameliorate our point of view, can't we?
So the dictionary defines experience as the contact, observation of, or encountering of things, events, and conditions as they occur over the course of time. So experience depends on two things. It depends on an event occurring, and it depends on our interaction with it. And the result of those two, the interaction of the individual and the event, results in the experience. So what are the different ways in which, what are the different results of an event that can be experienced? This helps explain the variety. And so this interaction can result in a feeling of pleasure, of pain, indifference, And so we judge the experience to be favorable, unfavorable, or inconsequential. The interaction can result in knowledge. It can result in wisdom. It can result in practical skill. It can result in the development of our character, for better or worse. It can inspire progress, or it can inspire or seem to cause us to give up, to regress. So individuals, we speak of the general human experience, and everybody knows what we're talking about. But the way in which individuals interpret it, react to it, determines the way we experience experience. And it's interesting that without that return of experience, because of that return of experience, cyclically, as we grow in our ability to judge, to discriminate, to perceive, to weigh, as we grow through experience, that experience, when it comes to us, is not the same. We interact with it differently. That's why, even though we may study the same books or the same chapters or the same lessons over and over again, and it comes back in a cycle, in the meantime, we've grown. So the very symbols, the words on the page or the lectures we hear have a different meaning, a different experience than they were for us the time before.
Well, does the attitude, therefore, have a determination on that which returns? I mean, if you are renouncing action, if you're not, when not renouncing it, but just not taking it personally and viewing it from an impersonal way, does that in itself have an effect?
What do you think? Is attitude key in the way we experience things?
TK.
Our attitude toward events as they occur in our lives very definitely even directs and influences our own evolution. Because the result could be that the experience is worthless and we gain nothing from it, or the result could be, with the right attitude, that it's a very valuable experience that is worthy of permanently impressing upon our inner nature.
So even if something is very painful and we would like to avoid it at all costs, you're saying that that could in fact be a valuable lesson for us?
We have to, if we handle these experiences in the right way. Now, of course, we all have things that are going to hit us blindsided that we had no idea was coming. So who knows, you know, maybe next time we'll be ready for it. But there's plenty of things that come our way that we either handle correctly or we don't, and we're going to benefit and grow from it or not. In that sense, the way we handle our experiences, the attitude with which we approach it, affect the individual's evolution.
So what is the difference between the return of an experience and the return of an impression or sensation? What's the difference? What does it mean by the return of an impression or the return of a sensation? Yes, TK.
Yeah, that's a great question. The return of an experience, perhaps the difference would be that the return of the experience is the sort of recreation of external conditions, but the return of impression is our response to those external conditions. So the return of impression, the same impression can return in response to very varying external experiences, but we may respond in a similar way, and that may be the opportunity to look at, to view, to morph, to change, to grow, and at the same time, an experience, the same exact experience can come, and we can handle it in different ways depending on how we're maturing through it. And the perfect example is the surfer. Someone who's been surfing knows what he's doing. He can be in the middle of the ocean or just off the beach, and a wave can come by, and he can choose not to take that wave depending on how he's going to position his body because he's talking to his friend next to him. Or the exact same wave can come by, and he can engage the wave. And if he manages himself, he can take it all the way in. Or the opposite, that wave can come by, and he can engage the wave and not manage his way in, but maybe he'll learn something from it. But he can only learn something from anything if he engages the wave.
JCS, you had a contribution?
Yeah, it would seem that impressions, whether from the greatest of cycle to the lowest of cycles, those are the conditions. But if we're not consciously aware, if we're not self-reflective, and the previous comment referred to this, the impressions come like waves, if you will, because matter has been impressed and all the lower lives and conditioning are at play. But as self-conscious entities, if we're not engaged, observant, recording, responding, assimilating, then there's no experience gained. There's no lesson learned. It's just an impression that may continue to hammer us, maybe, until that sense of I can observe this, what is there to learn, how can I do better? And that is experience gained.
So if we begin, LT, did you have your hand up? Okay. If we begin once again with the dictionary, a sensation is a kind of impression that we have that directly affects or comes to us through our nervous system, through our physical sensation. So every sensation we have has a tendency to return again and again. So the example is given in the literature of if we were to look at a light bulb and then on and then close our eyes, we would see that after image of the light bulb brightly, and then it would fade out, and then it would come again and fade out, come again. And each time it comes again, it's a little bit weaker until it finally fades out altogether. That's a returning cycle of sensation. Now, some of those sensations are through our physical senses and some of them are through our inner senses, but here's the difference. Impressions are the effects, this is what the dictionary says, we're modifying a little bit, are the effects, strong or weak, brief or enduring, produced on the thoughts, feelings, imagination, and memory by experience through the senses. In other words, impressions are the effects of experience we gather through the senses. And isn't it interesting that we speak of reincarnation of the soul through many cycles as a cycle of necessity in order to gain the experience of the gaining soul wisdom? It has to incarnate in the physical body, and the physical senses are a very important means or a very important tool to contacting the reality of the objective physical world. And it is through that contact and the impressions that come to us through the senses that our thoughts, our feelings, our imagination, our memory is impressed. And some of those impressions are noteworthy and we make the best use of them. And some of them are not noteworthy. It all depends, as brought out, on the attitude. So we can take a very pleasurable event, an event very pleasurable or painful to the senses. And with the right attitude, we can transfer, and the way it affects our memory and imagination and our desire and our will, we can transform that into spiritual knowledge. So the senses are not the problem. It's the misconceptions and the misuse of the senses for just the acquirement and satisfaction of our personal desires and ambitions, which is the problem. The senses of themselves are very important. That's the means by which we receive in sensation, impression, and experience. And it's necessary on this plane in order to gain complete knowledge. If we don't learn it, then that's why we reincarnate, or one of the reasons. LT.
I think, good morning. Just to add on to JS, is what she had stated earlier, is that, you know, every encounter that we're experiencing, there is that reflection of, you know, how does this, you know, evolve us, a matter of looking at every experience as, you know, whether it's negative or positive, and how does that evolve us? It's one thing to be grounded, but I think the overall is learning to have control of your senses and these cycles, and that these cycles are going to be continuous for eons to come. And so it's learning how to be in control of your senses as we age and as we, you know, go through this challenging cycles as we, you know, continue forward. And I think that's the important thing about it. And, you know, just being mindful in these cycles really calls for someone to be entirely centered and opened to their senses around themselves.
So how, what can we control about the senses, and what can't we control? Because there's some things we can control, but there's some things we can't control with the senses. As soon as we open our eyes or wake up in the morning, we're at the mercy of the senses and what happens during the day. So what can we control about the senses?
Is this an open question for anyone?
Anyone present?
It's just a matter of waking up. You know, the weather outside is, you know, maybe frightful, or, you know, how do we prepare for that? You know, we clothe ourselves and we take care of our, you know, ourselves to protect ourselves in nature. That's one thing that we can do. In dealing with relations is just another. You know, just have to be grounded and have to be centered. In our, some of our professions, we have to be very centered and very aware about our surroundings. We have to be above the senses of others and realize that there are aspects of humanity. That's just one field of work that, you know, some may relate to or not, but it definitely challenges us to be above our senses and be prepared for that.
I see the co-chair has a contribution.
Apparently not.
It'll return.
Yeah, we had one, but it sort of slipped away.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, it'll come back. So control of the senses, wouldn't that mean being that we can't help but see, feel, touch, hear, taste? Can't we control what we read? Can't we control what TV we watch? Can't we control what companionship we have? Can't we control where we work? Can't we control what music we listen to? Can't we control what we touch and feel, what we eat, what we smell? We can control what all those things. The question is, what is the purpose of our control? Why are we trying to control it? So the thing is not to repress the senses, but to control it in such a way that what we sense with any of our senses has a purpose, a higher purpose. It leads either to a balancing of our nature. It leads either to a greater realization of brotherhood. It leads either a greater understanding of spiritual self-consciousness. And so life becomes more open. The possibilities of experience and sensation become expanded through that selection, not decrease, expanded. Because we get out of our ruts, instead of following one particular sensation because we're just comfortable with it, now we're open to all kinds of sensations because they give us experience. And it's the same way with other impressions too.
But do we not always wish to train the will or develop the will so it becomes stronger? We know that we have heard that, you know, through the will we develop yoga, hatha yoga or tai chi, but we are told to train the body in that way has no lasting effect, so that we have to use our will to train what? What is it that we have to train? Our desires? Because it seems that if we don't control, and that, how do we exercise control? Through our will. Yes, JS.
Well, will is definitely a force. It's part of the greater cycles of manifestation, certainly. And it's particular to the plane on which we live. But isn't the control in the use of mind, in the creation and in invigorating of motive? So if we work on desire and motive and our use of mind, the application of will follow.
So will then is a universal principle, and on each of the planes it works differently. Working through the mind, will operates as self-consciousness. Working through the principle of desires, or desire, it operates in terms of feelings, passions, specific desires. So how do we control the will as human beings endowed with mind and passions? We can control what we want to be conscious of at the time, where we place our attention, where we place our self-conscious awareness. We can control that. In doing that, we control the expression of will. We can control how we want to feel and what we want to desire. When we do that, when we control our desires, we control the way will manifests. And as we raise or elevate our desires, as we raise or elevate what we attend to with our self-conscious awareness, the power of that universal will to accomplish things becomes that much greater, because our instrument has no longer been an impediment, but rather becomes an instrument of that will.
So therefore, we have to have the desire to help, the desire to gain more knowledge, to be of help, so that our motive has to be unselfish. Is that how we are to, you know, to look for that unselfish act? Or do we have to be more discriminating?
TK, did you have
No, actually we had a question that wasn't in response to this, so we put our hand down.
We don't have a few minutes left.
Well, so there's this chat on from ZZ, and it says, how many current affecting cycles could one consider during an event? Which specific amplitudes are not broadly distributed for security purposes? Could we have an explanation of what the question means and then dig into it and what the implications are? Like, for security purposes?
How many current affecting cycles could one consider during an event? Which specific amplitudes are not broadly distributed for security purposes? Well, we're not sure what the questioner has in mind, but let's interpret it. It means in when we experience an event, what are all the cycles that are involved in that? These cycles of incarnation, the return of certain impressions from this life, from a previous life, the influence of cycles of different nations and races, the cycles of the earth, the cycles of the sun, the cycles of the planets, the constellations. The entire universe is exposed to this karmic law. And it is said that the full mystery of the understanding of cycles is the knowledge of the adepts. They thoroughly understand cyclic law. And not all the cycles are given out to us. That's reserved, it is said, for the highest initiation. And we can understand that. To have the knowledge of the return of cycles gives one great power. Suppose you knew, for example, the cyclic return of certain investments as they were going to peak on the stock market. And you knew that as to be a fact. How many of us would take advantage of to use that for the benefit of others or for the benefit of ourselves? So too, there are certain cycles, the return or the knowledge of which could do great harm if it fell into the wrong hands. But there are other kinds of cycles which we generally know because they are acting on us now and we are going to experience them and we need to know how to respond to them at this time. And it's those kinds of cycles that we have information given to us in the philosophy. We spoke of a few of them in the initial talk, but there are others that are discussed. We're entering such a cycle now that we're going to be talking about in the next few weeks. The cycle that occurs around this, quote, Christmas time and the cycle of the solstice, the winter solstice, the new year. This is a very important cycle in nature that has spiritual, moral, ethical, psychic, physical, and mental implications. And if we are aware of that, we can make better use of it. So we're going to come to the end of our discussion at this point. Just to remind you that we have astral senses and powers. We gain our experience not just through the physical senses, but the astral senses and powers. That will be the subject of our Wednesday class. And next week, next Sunday, the universal symbolism of Christmas. And as we will see in those symbols is a reminder for the generations, regardless of one's faith or creed, of the significance of this time of year and the cyclic returns of impression in nature that we can use for the benefit of all and ourselves. Because in this work, no one can help themselves in a higher way that does not have a higher beneficial effect on others and vice versa. So at this time, we'll close our meeting and thank you all and looking forward to Zooming with you again in the future.